My name is Burns Breed. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I want to thank Virginia and the people who are responsible for inviting me to be here. It's always a delight and a pleasure to be at and a privilege to be at an AA meeting. It's always an honor to be asked to speak. I really do apologize to the speakers that I didn't get a chance to hear. Some of them I know very well, and I've heard them for years, and I really miss seeing them. I think this is probably only the second conference I've ever, over the years, have not been here for the entire thing, but I just literally was not physically capable of being here. And I regret not being with you, not getting in the middle of all the feelings and all the stuff that goes on at these conferences, which is so much more than just having speakers. And I miss that, but you just do what you have to do. The reason I wasn't here is last Sunday, I think I'm one of the few people that I know that makes golf a contact sport. And I was playing golf and threw my back out. I'm a doctor, and Rick's a doctor, and we were coming in today, and we were talking about what was wrong with my back, and we were talking about it in medical terms, and I said, yeah, I think I threw my back out. And we also talked a lot in medical terms coming in. I said, what was your diet? Tell me about yourself. He said, well, I was a drunk, like to die, and came to AA, and I'm happy. And I said, me too, and that was the way we covered that subject. But I am really grateful to be here. 2 days ago, I really didn't think I would be here, and I've been a doctor for 35 years, and I pretty much know the limitations of medicine today. Don't have a damn clue about my own limitations, but I pretty much have a limitation about medicine. And I knew that if I waited for traditional medicine to take care of my back, that I'd probably die. So I had three choices. One was take a bunch of pills and get goofy as hell and come out here and sing, and yep. And when I get through, about halfway through, you may think, take the pills and sing, you'll do a better job. The other was to go to a chiropractor, and I didn't have a problem with that, but I was afraid that he might do something to hurt me. And because when you go to chiropractors and things crunch, it seems to work, but God, it's hard for me to accept the fact that crunching is healthy, you know. So I went to see an acupressurist. Now, 20 years ago, before I got to AA, if you'd have told me about going to an acupressurist, I'd said, right, why don't you get naked and dive off the Empire State Building? You got about as much chance. It's working. I don't understand it, but it's kind of like AA. I don't understand that either, but it works. You know how that is? So he did all this funny things to my back, put his fingers in strange places and did all kinds of things. And by the time it was over, I was able to walk at least in a straight line. I have to turn, someone has to stop me and move me around a little bit, but it looks kind of strange, but it did work. So I'm here, made a proper amends to the people I've missed that I love dearly, and I'm just grateful to be with you. I don't mean to preach or teach in this talk, but the fact is I'll do both. And I apologize for neither. If there hadn't been preachers or teachers in my life, I'd be dead. I'm absolutely aware that some people in this room tonight came here and God put us together in this room because while I'm hearing what I need to hear, I'm going to say some things you need to hear. And for those people, you'll think this was probably the greatest single talk in your whole life. There'll be another group of people that will just say, it's enjoyable, but what's the big deal? Then there'll be some people who will be at least irritated by it. And for those of you who are irritated by it, God's given you a wonderful opportunity because you may have a lot of problems, but I promise you I'm not one of them. So everybody's going to go home with something, you know? Except those people who really haven't decided they want to quit drinking and they're going to go home with nothing, you know? And I found there's not a hell of a lot I can do about that. This talk is for me. It's also for the newcomer. The person who has come in these doors and is just begging and pleading and hoping that this will be home. It's for the individual with 1 year of sobriety who's been here just long enough to realize that you still can't find your car in a parking lot and can't zip your fly in public and be sure you're doing them both simultaneously with any degree of dignity. It'll be for the person with 2 years who thinks you finally got all the answers and you've got them in a box and you don't have a clue. It'll be for the person with 5 years of sobriety who has finally realized that there's something more than just absolutely self-willing going to meetings and self-willing reading the book and self-willing talking to a sponsor, and there will be a day of recognition that all of that, while necessary, isn't going to feed the baby. It'll be for that person with 10 years of sobriety who has reached a point in time where they once again have realized they don't have a clue and they don't know and they're terrified. They don't know to whom to talk or they're terrified to do it. And the person with 20 years who believes at this point in time that life is so good and they've got it so well nailed that they don't need to continue to follow the rules. Or the person with 30 years who's gone into back enclaves because AA isn't like it used to be. You know, how many old-timers does it take to change the light bulb? It takes 6. 5 to change it and 1 to tell you how wonderful the old light bulb was. Or the 42-year-old person who decides that it's better to drink and not lose the new person, significant other, who's come in his life because he's too terrified to lose that person. Every one of those people I've talked to you about, I've made 12 tip calls on. Every one of them. And this talk's for every one of them. I decided some time ago, about 3 years ago, I guess, that what I said based on, or what I say based on my experience and my strength and my hope is far more important than whether you like me or not. And I finally decided to tell the truth. It's been my experience. It may not be exactly all I'm going to learn in this program, because I got a lot more road to hoe and a lot more things to learn, because I'm excited about it. But the main thing that is, I decided 3 years ago there were just too damn many people dying, and I'm not in charge of who lives or who dies, but I'm damn sure in charge of the message I carry for them to hear. And that was much more important to me than whether you like me. The miracle of recovery, for me it is a miracle. Fascinatingly enough, it ceases to be a miracle that is wrapped in smoke, mirrors, and magic. There is a distinct mystery about it. That mystery seems to be because I'm not able to see the full circle. If I'm blessed enough to see that circle close, I do see the mystery. But most of the things, I haven't seen the circle close. But I can promise you from my experience, it's not smoke, mirrors, and magic. And the miracle of recovery, I want to share with you two stories that give you an indication of what, at least in my mind and in my experience today, represents that miracle of recovery. There was a woman talking, who's been sober now over 30 years, and she was talking at the state conference in Knoxville, Tennessee, and she was describing when she first got sober. You remember when we go through that stuff for that year where nothing makes any sense, and she was just absolutely almost robotic in the way she responded to things. And she lived in an area of Nebraska where the winters were real, real hard, and she'd been sober a month or two, and she would go out and she would put food out for the wild animals. And that's what she could do and have some dignity. And she would go to her meetings and try to follow the leader and make some sense. But that was what she did because those were God's creatures. And by the spring, she would go out there and the animals didn't have to come and find the food anymore because they had more food, but they would still come up and she would feed them. And she was getting clearer herself. And she went out that day and put the food down and turned to walk away, and she felt something. And she turned, and this fox was sitting about 5 feet from her with its front legs out in front of it, its back legs hunched up under it, looking right straight at her. And she said, I looked in that fox's eyes, and the fox was saying, Peggy, thank you for saving my babies. Now, I've hunted all my life, neither proud of it nor ashamed of it. I don't do much of it anymore. That's fascinating, but I used to do a lot of it. And I've seen animals in that position many times, and what I saw was, I'm watching you, you SOB, and you come one step closer, I'll bite you or get the hell out of here because you're going to hurt me. But the miracle of recovery is what she saw in that animal's eyes was, thank you for saving my babies. It wasn't a change in what she saw. It was a change in how she saw it. There's a couple from Bessemer, Alabama that's been sober. She's the alcoholic, been sober about 15 years. And Bo, her husband's been in Al-Anon the same time, and they are really, really good representatives for God's grace in this program. And they had a son die. He was not alcoholic. He was killed in a car accident. And I watched Shirley about 5 or 6 years ago, and she, I've been blessed to hear her talking about him. She was angry. I mean, angry. She said it from the podium. I don't understand. He was a good kid. We loved him, and he loved us. Why did God do this? And she would just sit there and rant from the podium. She did this for about, I saw her twice in 1 year, and it was the same. And I've been blessed to see her over the last 5 years on a couple of occasions each year, and I could see the evolution begin to occur because she stayed right with her program. I saw the softness begin to come in. I saw, you could, if you want to get technical, these are stages of grief. If you want to get what I saw, they were the program in action. And last year I talked within the past 6 months down at Callaway Gardens in Georgia. And I don't know if you've ever been there, you probably haven't, but if you have, they have a conservatory and that has thousands of butterflies in there that flutter around, and they have perfect temperature, and you walk in there and those butterflies are all around you. It's a wonderful place to go into. And this young man that got killed, his name was Mike. And Shirley and I were standing there talking, and this butterfly landed right on her stomach. And as we talked, the butterfly just walked up her chest and walked over right on the end of her breast. And she looked at me and looked down at that butterfly, and she said, "Burns, you know that's Mike. He's come to say it's okay, Mom." Now see, it doesn't matter a shit to me whether you think that's really God or not. What I saw was the miracle of recovery in the attitude of this mother who had lost her child. And this was God's message rather than God's blame. It was not a change in what she saw. It was a change in how she saw it. And what's occurred in my life in this miracle of recovery has been just that, and I want to share it with you. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. My birthday or my last drink in AA was December the 1st, 1977. And I came into AA in Louisville, Kentucky in a period of time what I call the dark ages of Alcoholics Anonymous in Louisville. The edict when you came into AA at that point in time, and there's a young man here who was in the middle of all that, and God, it was wonderful to see him. Just anyway, when you came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Louisville at that time, the edict was don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell him everything that's wrong with you, he'll tell you what to do, and then go save a drunk. And that was the program. I came in absolutely willing to be taught and willing to follow, and that's what I did. If you look at that, that's basically a 3 1/3 step program. It's the first 3 steps and a third of the 12th step, and that's what I had for 9 years in this program, was a 3 1/3 step program. I mean, I was all over Louisville, Kentucky. I had a sponsor who told me what to do. I did it, and then I went and saved drunks. I became a lethal weapon for God. I mean, that's exactly what I was. I mean, the story was, here he comes, you better drink a beer because he's going to take you to treatment anyway. It doesn't make any difference. And I want you to know, as you can well imagine, if you've ever lived that kind of program, after 9 years in this program, I was goofier than a goat. There were two things that kept me sober during that first 9 years. One was alcohol whipped me. I'm one of those blessed people that when I got here, I had nowhere else to go. I'd had 8.5 years of psychiatric therapy. I'd been deacon in 5 churches. I had a strong, thriving medical career. I had everything that you could want, except I was drinking a quart of whiskey a night, and the church and psychiatric therapy brought me a lot of things that would serve me in good stead later on, but they didn't keep me from drinking whiskey. And drinking a quart of whiskey a night, it finally beat me. And when I crawled into AA, I was just praying that you had the answer for me. It whipped me. I tell you, I was powerless over alcohol. I don't mean powerless because I couldn't quit drinking. I was powerless because I couldn't get it to work. It would stop the diarrhea, and it would stop the sweating, it would stop the withdrawal, but it didn't stop the noise, and it didn't stop the shame and the guilt and the pain. It wouldn't work. I've never needed a medal for not going back and taking a drink because it didn't work. But it kept me sober. The second thing that kept me sober was working with all these newcomers, because I was able to get out of my own self-centeredness by being everywhere in somebody else's mess. My sponsor once told me, as a doctor, he said, "You got a license to steal." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you go from room to room to room examining people, and all day long you listen to somebody else's problems so you don't get your head up your butt listening to your own." And he was right. Between my practice and running all over town, all over the state, and grabbing sick people, I was able to stay out of my own self-centeredness. And I went to enough meetings and would follow my sponsor's direction. And at 9 years in the program, I wasn't thinking about taking a drink, but I was thinking about maybe running off from my wife or maybe killing myself, whichever came first, you know. And driven to my knees by a series of events that are classical self-centeredness, I became a student of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I became and did what the book told me, and my program went to a 12-step program. And I've lived 9 years in a 3 1/3-step program, and I've lived 10 years, almost 11 years, in a 12-step program. And I got to tell you, the difference is daylight and dark. And people who come up to me and say, "I can't seem to get this program," my first question is, "Where are you in the book? How are you in the steps? Tell me how your day goes. How do you do it?" And 99 times out of 100, if they're just friggin' miserable, that's because they aren't doing the work or following the directions. They're just friggin' miserable. And let me tell you, you can take it to the bank. Why wouldn't they be miserable if they're a drunk like me? Only two things I found you got to do to stay sober. One is don't drink, and the other is change everything else you're doing. And it doesn't happen overnight. Not for me. The series of events that drove me to my knees were this. All alcoholics take hostages. Now, sometimes we call them pigeons or babies or sponsees, but we have to be. You show me a man with 40 sponsees, I'll show you a sick SOB, you know? Because he hadn't got 40 sponsees, he's got 40 hostages. And he's notching them on his belt. And if anybody has that and say, "Well, he's talking about me," you damn right I'm talking about you. And I get to go home tomorrow. You got to stay here with this crazy shit, you know? But all alcoholics take hostages, and I had my major hostage was my wife. Now, if you look in the big book in the 5th chapter and 4th steps, as we go back through our lives, nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty, right? That's what it says. So to go back through my life, let me take you back, and anybody has problems, say, "This is psychiatric." No, it isn't. It's what the big book says. Going back through my life, what I found was my relationship with my mother. My mother, her daddy died drinking. My grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail. He was the town drunk. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. They had an interesting way of treating alcoholics in Mayfield, Kentucky, which was a town of 12,000 in the middle 30s. When my granddaddy got drunk, they put him in jail. When he sobered up, they put him in a chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. And my mother used to walk past her daddy sweeping the Mayfield City streets at least once a week. Imagine the shame. If you don't believe all this, read the family afterward. It says if you're around one of us, you get neurotic. Wilson used the word neurotic, and mother was neurotic. Lovely lady, just goofy. I mean, just goofy. And why shouldn't she have been goofy with all that garbage? They didn't have adult children in 1935. They didn't even have AA yet. And Al-Anon was nothing but a glint in Lois Wilson's eye. And my mother was goofy. And her whole ego structure came out of her children, me and my brother. My daddy told me that when I was born, he walked into the delivery room, and my mother was holding me, and she said, "No, Brady had ever been to college." And she looked at my daddy and said, "Hal," said, "this one's going to be a doctor." I always wondered why I wanted to be a doctor. Hell, I was pointed at, "You're going to be a doctor," you know? And I found that when I was perfect, mother would talk to me. When I wasn't perfect, mother wouldn't. So I became perfect. And when I was perfect, my mother shined my butt, parted my hair, picked up my dirty clothes, and I was king baby. King baby. And my working description for all women in my life, without even defining it, was the perfect woman was the one who took care of me and made me feel special. You can well imagine that any woman who came in my life didn't stay very long with that job description. The ones who did were just really goofy. I mean, they were just goofy. You know, and I mean, when the rocks in my head fit the holes in one of theirs, I mean, by God, we had a relationship, you know? And that's the way it was. Well, I didn't know all that, but that's the way it was. And so when my wife and I, my first wife, took her about 17 years because she really was, the rocks in my head fit the holes in hers or vice versa, and she stuck around for 17 years because she was just about as sick as me, and finally I drank enough whiskey and walked over her dignity enough that she kicked me out. And I womanized for about 2 years and met Casey. Casey was one of the neatest people and is one of the neatest people that I've ever seen. She's my wife today. And we moved in together after about a 24-hour courtship. And and she didn't have rocks. She didn't have holes in her head. That's interesting. She really didn't, which was one of the reasons that I decided to get sober, because I finally found somebody that wasn't all that sick. But after we'd been together, she quit drinking when I quit drinking, went into Al-Anon for 7 years. Then she came out and went into the program, went into AA at the end of 7 years, and I won't get into all that. But after about 2 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, she came to me and she said, "Burns, I've never loved you more, but I want to go to college, and I want to go to my own meetings," because I took her to, remember we went to the meetings together? I mean, everywhere I went, Casey was right there on my hip. I mean, I was a benevolent dictator. I bought her wonderful clothes, bought her new cars, took her place, never asked her what the hell she wanted to wear or what car she wanted to drive. I just went and bought it for her. That's the way it was. I mean, it never occurred to me that she could walk, talk, and chew gum. I obviously had to walk and talk and chew her gum for her. I mean, I didn't think that. That's what I did. You know, I was a benevolent dictator. It just didn't, and she fit the job description beautifully. And it was a wonderful relationship. We did the third step prayer in the morning. It was a wonderful relationship. So I gave her everything I had. All I expected was her to give me everything she had on my terms. I didn't know that. I didn't have a clue. At 9 years, she came and she said, "Burns, I want to go back to college. I want to go to my own meetings, and I want to go into therapy." What I heard was, "You're leaving me." You know, it never was stated, but that's what I heard. And what does a drunk do who's getting ready to lose his hostage? Goes and gets another one, right? So I had a nurse working for me, and the job description for nurses in a doctor's office is they just go everywhere you go and do everything you're supposed to do to take care of the doctor. And we'd been together for 2 years. It was a perfectly professional relationship. And within 6 months, this woman began to look like the Virgin Mary and the Second Coming of Christ and Joan of Arc all at one in one body, you know? Hell, she was perfect. I mean, it got to the point I did not have that much of a relationship with her. You know, a little bit pregnant type deal. You know, I didn't have that much. Didn't have that much of a relationship. I'm just a little bit of a drunk, right? I didn't have that much of a relationship. But I reached a point in time after 3 or 4 months with that where I decided that I love both of these women. And what I needed to do was convince them that all three of us could live together. And see, I'm 50 years old and 9 years sober at this time, right? That means I'm 9 years without a drink and 50 years crazy. That's exactly what it meant. I'd been with y'all long enough that I knew there was one rule you can't break in this program and get it. One rule. And that is, you can't be dishonest. And I, even in my insanity, knew this was not honest. And I thought, I don't know what to do. About that time, a little pigeon of mine came up to me and gave me these 8 tapes. You know, when the student's ready, the teacher will invariably and inevitably arrive. In this program, it's been my experience. And this little pigeon came up and gave me these 8 tapes and said, "Listen to these tapes and see if they're any good." And as I listened to these tapes, they were Joe and Charlie's tapes of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I listened to those tapes, I knew the program that I didn't have. I had 12 copies of those tapes, or 11 copies made, and 12 of us guys got together, and we began to study the Big Book and do what it said. I've listened to speakers from the podium say, "What are these Big Book studies?" and cast disparaging remarks. Well, I need to tell you that a Big Book study done in the proper way, where the book is studied and then done and acted and a program of action, has been invaluable to a hell of a lot of people in my community, and certainly to me. And anyone who wants to crack on those needs to go home, get on their knees and pray, because I ain't talking about their God, and they need to get off of mine. That's some of the preaching. I'll get to the teaching later. In any event, this is, we began to do this, and my world began to change. I began to change. The insight began to grow. I began to have a full 12-step program, and I began to know what Bill Wilson was talking about and why he wanted to write this book and why it was important. I go to 5 meetings a week today. 2 of those are big book studies. One of them I lead. One of them I participate in. One is in a men's homeless shelter where we sleep 200 men a night. We have 100 of those men in a year-long program of recovery using recovery dynamics. And all day for 6 months, they study the big book as a textbook, and at night they go to AA meetings. With God's grace and with a bunch of us working together, we have a recovery rate in homeless men of approximately 25%. And that was considered an untreatable population. Untreatable population. As I studied this book, I began to find some interesting things about it, about me. The first thing I found out about this, when studying this book, is that my problem is not alcohol. Now, before I go any further, for the little pitcher who has big ears out there who just walked in, I need to say this. I'm also an addictionist. There aren't many people in the country today who have had the experience and the knowledge combined that I have. That is not an arrogant statement. That's just a simple statement of fact. Now, I can sit here and draw on this wall here almost every formula that will validate exactly what Silkworth meant when he said we have a physical allergy and a mental obsession. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, you're playing 2 sandwiches short of a picnic in regard to alcohol. That's just the way it is. And I don't care how well you read this book and work this program, you'll never get to where you can drink whiskey like a normal person. So you might as well give it up. And I need to say that before I go any further, because I found out that my problem is not alcohol. 5th chapter, 4-step, alcohol is a symptom. 7th chapter, at the end of the 12-step, the bottle is a symbol. What it told me was is that my problem is my mind. The most devastating 6 inches in history is the distance between my ears. My problem is my mind. And interestingly enough, he called it a peculiar mental twist, a way of thinking, a peculiar mental twist. I was talking in East Texas. And Claire, you may remember. Do you remember Damon that died? That was down there. Damon died last year, I guess it was. He's about 90 years old and had 50 years of sobriety. And I was talking at Beaumont, and Damon was the voice of the conference. And Damon always talked like he had a flat brainwave. I mean, he just did. But if you listen to him, he was really funny. So I got right down in the front row and I listened to those old timers because they're talking about stuff that is not recorded in the history books. I really live by what the black lines in the book, but I'm fascinated by what they can tell us about what's on the white lines in the book, because those things will never be recorded, and we'll lose that with that generation. And that makes me sad, but that's just the way life is. In any event, I got right down on the front row, and I listened closely to Damon because he was just funny. He told this wonderful story, which is the best example of the alcoholic peculiar mental twist I've ever heard. He said there was this traveling salesman that traveled in East Texas, and he was what we call in Western Kentucky bad to drink. And he would travel from town to town. He'd stay a week in Beaumont, and he would check into the motel, and he'd get drunk every night. And then every day he'd go out and sell, and he'd come back in and get drunk every night. And every night when he'd get drunk and check into his hotel room or come back, they'd have him set up in ways to keep his business. You know, booze in there and all sorts of attractions. So he did this for years, and finally one day, like a lot of us, he had all this fun he could tolerate, and he went back home and either got into a treatment program or went to AA, but he quit drinking and decided he wanted to live a different type of life. So he came back after he'd been gone for a month or two, and he got back on his circuit, and he checked into this motel. Of course, they didn't know he'd have a change in life. He goes out and sells all day, comes back in, checks into his motel. Well, that night he goes out to go to an AA meeting, and they think he's going out to get drunk like he always does. So when he comes in and checks in, he opens the door and flips on the light. Sure enough, they've got him set up to keep his business. There beside the bed's a fifth of whiskey and a couple of big tubs of ice. And on the foot of the bed sit these 2 beautiful women. And he looks at that scene for a minute, and he says, well, I started going to AA, and I asked them what I had to do to stay sober and be happy, and they told me I had to quit drinking and change everything I'm doing. So I can't drink that whiskey, and one of you girls is going to have to leave. I I've been telling that joke for 5 years, and I love it. I just answer it. And the reason I love it is because I can relate to it. And every drunk in the room can relate to it. Because that's the major part of the peculiar mental twist. Let me go over the peculiar mental twist the way my mind works. The thing I have to deal with every day with the mechanisms we teach each other so that I don't take a drink. Because this is the way my mind works. And the first part of the peculiar mental twist for me is being bigger than the rules. The rule was he had to quit drinking and change everything he's doing. He's going to quit drinking and change half of the things he's doing. Being bigger than the rules. I've got 9 points on my out of 12 points on my driver's license for speeding. Anytime there's a 65-mile-an-hour speed zone, I go 95. And it just pisses the cops off, and they pull me over, and they give me a ticket. And one day I was sitting there at home thinking about this, and I said, Burns, you need to think about this. Are you stupid? And I thought, well, no, I'm not stupid. Well, are you crazy? Well, no, I'm not crazy. Well, then why do you do that? And I thought, because I'm Burns Brady. Think about that, because I'm Burns Brady. That's part of my peculiar mental twist. I'm bigger than the rules. Handicapped parking zone. I got 30 seconds. I got to be in the post office. Nowhere to park. Boom, sit there. I'm only going to be here 30 seconds. You can't do that. You can't do that. Rick, you can't do that. I can do that. Why? Because I'm Burns Brady. And you know that's dumb. And if you did it, I'd know it's dumb. When I do it, it just seems perfectly natural. Perfect. And translate that right on into how I prepare my day. You read the 11th step and you follow the 11th step, or at least I do, and I go in and I sit down and I take my meditation time and I do the 11th step prayer the way it's written, the 7th step prayer, the 3rd step prayer. I spend a lot of time and I've done a lot of work in the book on where love and tolerance is manifested, because I'm not tolerant of a red light. I'm not tolerant of you at a red light. I'm not tolerant of me at a red light. And I have to really work on that with God's grace and bringing God into my life. And then if I sit there real quietly for another 10 or 15 minutes and don't think a thing, just sit there and I think, don't think, man. Don't think, man. Quit thinking, man. I'm thinking. I know you're thinking. Damn it, quit thinking. And then I'll sit there. And I'll sit there, and then I... Well, who's in the room with me? Nobody's in the room with me. I must be thinking by myself. You know, and there you are. But if I do it long enough, finally there'll come a day, and there has come a day, when I can sit there and I can feel, after I've done my preparation, I can feel the power and the presence of this power greater than me that I choose to call God. This love, this peace, this quietness, this thing that stops my motor. Why don't I do that every morning? Why don't you do it every morning? Because you're playing by the same set of rules I'm playing by. Because you're just Burns Brady. And when I do that and lead my life with a 10th step every day and close it with a 12th step every day, my life is better. Every single time. It's predictable. It will be better. Maybe what happens won't be better, but I am better in the way I react to it and the way I feel going into it. Why don't I do that every day? Because I'm bigger than the rules. About a year ago, my wife, they call it a cyclothymic personality. That means I go woo, 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 just like that. If you haven't figured it out, you're seeing the best tonight. You ought to have seen me in my real heyday. Or you ought to be with me. I mean, I go up and down like a yo-yo, and there are times when I get into a bunker mentality. I used to get like this because I think you're going to criticize me, and I didn't want to hear you. Now I do it because I know when I'm like this that I'm liable to hurt you. And when I came into AA, I came in here because I was tired of hurting people. If there was one motivating force that kept me here and kept me from pulling the shotgun that was in my mouth, it was because I didn't want to hurt people anymore. And I get like that, and it takes about 24 hours. I hell, the best psychiatrists in the country have seen me. They've offered me everything from ice water enemas to Zoloft. It doesn't matter what the hell they offer me. I mean, but I get like this. And I just hunker down for about 24 hours. It doesn't hit me that often. But when I do this. And nobody can access me. And I move away so that I'm not around where I can hurt people or they can even come in and touch me. This particular Saturday morning, I'm down like that, and my wife pulled her chair over next to the bed, and she said, I love you more than anything. And I'm going to tell you something that nobody else... Rick's right. In Louisville, I'm hot shit. I really am. And even the people who don't think I'm hot shit won't tell me that. You know, that's just they just won't tell me that. And the reason I am is because I'm a devout member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really, with God's motivation, doing some things that, with my training, with my education, and with God's direction, and my sponsor in this program, I have made things happen. And God has used me to do that. So very few people, except my sponsor, will even take the risk. And my wife pulled that chair up, and she said, "Burns," she said, "I just can't stand to see you hurt like this. I need to tell you something." She said, "You've gotten bigger than the program." And I looked at her and I thought, how could she say that? I mean, all you got to do is go with me. I mean, I'm everywhere carrying the message. How could she say that? And she said, "No, you don't believe that," but said, "You've gotten bigger than the program." I said, "Oh, you don't mean to." I said, "How, Casey?" And she said, "You haven't called your sponsor in 6 months." She was right, wasn't she? First part of the peculiar mental twist: bigger than the rules. Second part of the peculiar mental twist: victimization. If it weren't for you, I wouldn't be having a problem. What I said tonight about if anybody is angry at me when they walk out of here tonight, I can promise you I'm not your problem. But you have decided to be a victim of this talk. You've decided to be, and I'm glad I afforded an opportunity, because if it wasn't me, it would be something else. Victimization. Oh, I milked victimization as long as I could. I was born very poor. I drugged that sucker all the way to hell and back, didn't I? Yes, sir. Well, yeah, you drink whiskey too if you born poor and had to live in a house where there was no furniture and couldn't belong to the country club, had to carry their bags. And I remember walking down that fairway carrying those bags and those little bastards diving in the swimming pool, and I'd think, I wish they'd rot in hell, you know. I had mother and daddy didn't have enough money. I had to work my way through college. They couldn't buy me a car. I had to work to get my own car. Oh yeah, if I'd had money, I wouldn't have had to marry that rich bitch I hated for 17 years. You know, I mean, I'd go through the whole litany, you know. I mean, I had a drill that was right on target, and I could do it. Well, I had my heart attack 3 years ago, nearly died. Oh, you should have seen me for a year after that. I mean, I was poor, pitiful Burns. Oh, God, I can't move. I can't do anything. You know, my prostate's getting enlarged. My bladder's going to blow out. Hell, I'm through, you know. Can't get it up. Hell, it's the whole deal, you know. Oh, man, I had the whole drill. It was right on target. Victimization. Oh, me poor, pitiful burn. You know, when Wilson talked about self-pity, think about it. He's talking about victimization. Person in self-pity has decided they will be a victim of their environment and the circumstances. And when I get that way, the misery stays as long as I allow it to stay, but not using the things you've told me. Wilson knew we wouldn't understand being bigger than a rule, so he called that self-centeredness. He knew we wouldn't understand victimization as a term, so he called that resentment. The third part of my peculiar mental twist is what I call the square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. If the square peg won't fit in the round hole, just get a hammer and beat that SOB till it fits. It's just kind of like the way I used to when I was drinking. I put my kids' toys together on Christmas Eve. You know, if it rolled, it was theirs. That's just the way it was. It may have started out to be a bird bath, but it ended up looking like a tricycle. You know, that's just the way it was. And that's the way I've led my life. Square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. What does all that mean? I'll tell you what it means to me. Why is it necessary for me to make that square peg fit in that round hole? Because I've got to control every minute of my life. The most significant part of the 12 steps to me, where it breaks down, if you believe you're powerless over alcohol, is the second half of the first step. Who's going to manage my life? I'm not talking about the unmanageability of life when I sat in the treatment center and watched and looked at my roommate hanging in his closet. I'm not talking about the unmanageability of life when I couldn't do my medical charts or make my rounds because I was drinking a quart of whiskey a night. I'm talking about the unmanageability of life when I'm trying to make everybody fit into that square peg round hole syndrome. Most people who get drunk that I've worked with don't get drunk over the first half of the first step. They get drunk over the second half of the first step. Let me tell you, When we do an evaluation as addictionists, and we do an evaluation on someone for alcoholism, we have multiple ways we can do it. But one of the tests we use is called a MAST test. And there are approximately 25 questions on that test. And each question is given so many points. And if you take that test and you get more than 5 points, in all probability, you're alcoholic. And one of the questions is, have you ever been to an AA meeting? If the answer is yes, that's 5 points. So there's not a person in this room that came in here with an alcohol problem that didn't know you got an alcohol problem. Hopefully, most of you are looking for a solution so that you can be happy and not have to drink again. And some of you may be looking for a loophole. But you came in here knowing damn well you got a problem. And in all probability, if you relapse, you're not going to relapse because you have forgotten you're powerless over alcohol. You'll relapse when the pain is so friggin' great when you can't manage life. The closest I've been to screwing up royally is when I can't make life fit the square peg in the round hole. And why is it necessary for me to do that? Because I'm terrified. I'm terrified to let God run my life because I don't think He'd get the answer right. And so it is an absolute surrender deal. And if you're new in this program, I'm going to tell you what I face every day is, am I going to let God run my life or am I? Am I going to let God run my life or am I? And I'll tell you something else. Once I've decided I'm going to let God run my life, then what I did for a number of years after that, or at least for a period of time, was I stopped at the third step rather than using that as a place to start. I used page 449 in the big book in the third step as one of the greatest escape clauses in any contract. Because when I got to that point, I let God run my life, and He's saying, I can't stop this damn car if you don't step on the brake. You know the wonderful joke about the guy at the lottery? Said, God, I really am busted. I don't have any money. He said, I really want to win the lottery. Lottery came, went. He said, well, God, I didn't win the lottery. And next one's coming along. God, I'm really busted. I need to win the lottery. Goes and comes, doesn't win. Third time, he said, God, I'm really serious. I'm busted. I need to win the lottery. And his voice said, meet me halfway, Herschel. Buy a ticket. Because once I've decided in the morning that God's going to run my life, then I've got the responsibility to do the work. I've watched so many people in a meeting say, that's a third step issue. No, it's not. It's a 12-step issue. I don't turn things over at the third step except my will. After that, I get off my ass and do it, and I end up getting my will back in the 10th step the way it's written, and then I really do go from there and constantly praying for my God on the days when I'm not crazy. On the days when I'm not crazy, I just grab the closest tree that's my sponsor and hang on. Self-centeredness, resentment, and fear. Well delineated in our book as to how to deal with it. One of the reasons I've loved AA so much is it gave me my first practical spiritual solution. Everything else where I was involved with spirituality wanted me to take a leap of faith that did not make sense. There's nothing about AA, thank God, that doesn't make sense. There's only one solution that I'm aware of that will work for alcoholism of my type and that kind of thinking, and that's spiritual. Again, I think that many people have made smoke, mirrors, and magic out of this program, and spirituality for me is not smoke, mirrors, and magic. It's very practical. And I'm going to give you my diagram for spirituality. Some of you may be anal retentive like I am, and it'll really help you. Some of you may not be, so you can go to sleep for the next 5 minutes. Spirituality for me is a triangle. And this triangle is on its point, sitting on a base. One corner of that triangle is sponsor. The other corner of that triangle is meetings. The third corner of that triangle, the one it's standing on, is the big book. And in the big book, it's trust God, clean house, and help others. And that's sitting on a base of honesty and one day at a time. And if my life is going to stay in balance, those components have to be in balance. When I get crazy and somebody says, you're out of balance, it isn't whether I'm going to church or working in the community. It's which one of those things am I not doing? Have I not talked to my sponsor today? Am I missing a meeting that I really normally go to? Have I bullshitted my way out of going to it? Have I not done my big book work today and my 12-step work today to begin my day, to enact my day, and to close my day? When I'm sitting at a red light and turns green, the guy behind me honks, if my first reaction is to give him a finger, then I'm not in the program. If my first reaction is give him the finger and I don't, then I'm in the program. If my first reaction after that is to say a prayer for him, then I'm really in the program today. Now, for those of you who are early in the program, you'll find that one thing about this program will improve your judgment. Next time a person honks at you, you'll look in the mirror before you give them the finger, because it could be somebody kick your ass, you know. Then there'll come a day when you'll pray. And you say, is this recovery? It is for me. It happens at red lights. Happens at stop signs. It happens at when I'm behind a school bus going to school and I've decided I'm going to be 30 minutes late and the school bus is inching and inching and inching and inching, and I'm thinking, ooh, why don't they put all those little bastards in a sack and carry them all at the same time, you know? Instead, I say, thank God these kids are getting a good education and maybe they'll learn more about alcoholism than I knew, and it won't keep them from being an alcoholic, but they'll at least know where to go to get the solution. Sponsorship. I've had three sponsors. My first sponsor truly, truly was mentally ill. When somebody says, I've got a kick-ass sponsor, I'm not really impressed. Because I say, you also got a will to die. You know what I mean? Why am I impressed with a kick-ass sponsor? No, this man is truly mentally ill. Now, I've looked back on why this man came in my life, and God doesn't make mistakes. And this man was in my life for 9 years, and he brought me stuff that only this man could have brought. Honest to God. I mean, I do not advise anybody having the relationship with a sponsor that I had with my first sponsor, but it was exactly right for me. I remember I was so full of terror and had so much, as a doctor with a practice that I had and being my age and with a lot of the things I could look in the computer and say that it worked, after the fear, or basically after some of the shame and guilt left, then I became someone who was just terrified but had all sorts of places I could go to say I'm okay. Only this man wouldn't let me go there. I can remember one night he came. First of all, he came in, he told my wife. We sat down, and Casey and I sat with Jim, and Jim said, Burns, I want you to tell Casey that she can call me if you start being an idiot. I said, well, I'll tell you. He said, no, you won't. I said, why won't I tell you? He said, because you want to impress me. I said, I don't believe that. He said, you'll believe it. He said, tell her anyway. I don't give a damn whether you believe it or not. Tell her anyway. She said, well, I'm in Al-Anon, and my sponsor said I couldn't call. He said, bullshit. Call me if he starts to act out. And I really love it when I sat with an Al-Anon sponsor and me with the two people, the husband and wife, and the big book gives us all sorts of leeway to do this as we sat working with our programs together rather than his and hers and polarized programs, which nauseate me. Because people keep dying over isolated, polarized programs. So she said, okay, I'll tell you. Well, it wasn't 2 weeks till I had these little 2-pound barbells. That tells you how physical I was at that time. I really was beat up by the whiskey, but I would stand there and I would just throw the 2-pound barbells through the back of the closet door. I just knocked all the plywood out, and all the stuff out of the back of the wall. And Casey would stand over in the corner. I never was fussing at her. I was just so terrified. I mean, I'd wake up in the morning and all I felt was, I can't get out of bed. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's going to whip the shit out of me, whatever it is, you know? And I just throw those barbells through the back of the door, and I went to work that morning, and I said, Mr. Riley wants you to call him. So I called, and he said, Burns, you going to be at the meeting tonight? I said, yeah. And he said, I'd like to talk with you. And I said, okay, Jim. So I hung up, and that night we got in there, and after the meeting, he got a car. He said, what the hell are you throwing the 2-pound barbells through the back of the wall for?
Well, how'd you know? Well, Case told me. Well, I'll just tell her a thing. Do you tell her a thing, do not whip your ass right here in this car. Now, I don't know what's spiritual about that, but I'm sober. So I got home and I said, you call Jim. And she said, yes, I called Jim. And I said, don't you ever call him again. She walked right on, picked up the phone and said, Jim, he's fussing at me. And here he came. And he was 20 years older than me. He was smarter than me. And he was about 6'5". And one night he came in, and I mean, I was really raising hell and ranting and carrying on. And he started saying, do this, do this. And I said, I've had all you I can take, and just picked up a chair. And I said, I'll just brain you. And he just reached over and picked up a chair, and he said, I'm bigger than you, and I'll hit you first. Now, I'm not advocating that for any of you. I'm telling you, God gives us what we need if we're willing to show up, suit up, and stand there and listen. And that's exactly what he gave me. Second sponsor was not like that at all. This was Jack S. Jack had me for 9 years. He taught me love and tolerance, because Jack is opinionated about everything from root rot to the Vietnam War. And he'll tell you in a heartbeat. But I found he could tolerate it. And I wanted to know how he did that. And he led me for 9 years. He was the one I hadn't talked to in 6 months. But we had nothing else to say. And Jack knew that, and I did. My sponsor now came in the program with me. Same time. And we meet every Tuesday for breakfast. Go to two meetings together. And my life has gotten a lot saner. Meetings, I found by going to meetings a lot of things. First of all, I found out that by going to meetings that AA is a perfect program composed of a lot of real crazy people. And I mean, tell you, when I came in AA, and you remember Casey, pretty girl. And I mean, there were people hitting on my wife within 5 minutes from the time we walked in the door. Now, I didn't appreciate that, but I understood. There were people hitting on me. And I looked like the wrath of God. I had a pot belly, little bitty legs, little bitty arms, alcohol acne. I didn't want to sleep with me. And there was somebody trying to take me to bed all the time. And I found out in AA, you got people that'll jump a stump if it's standing there long enough. They don't do it long if they got a sponsor like Jim who'll brain them. I also, Wilson talked about principles over personalities for a distinct reason. I've watched people get drunk over personalities. The principles are perfect. The personalities are evolving from very sick to getting very close to God, and that doesn't happen overnight. If you haven't found the person that you want to follow and you don't know who's got the white hats and the black hats on, find the winners. I'm a winner. Don't expect us to walk on water. We can't do that. We don't know where the stumps are. And if we really are winners, we'll tell you we are just capable of all kinds of insanity. But we'll take you to a meeting and we'll let you talk to our sponsor and we'll talk with you. Find your winners and you'll be okay. I also found out them that don't go to meetings don't hear what happens to them that don't go to meetings. There either is a solution, it'll say there'll come a day, paraphrase, there'll come a day we'll be unable to bring into our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation of a week or a month ago. We literally forget what went on in our lives. Great gift of God. Medical science calls it state conditioned learning. I call it a great gift of God because he allowed me to forget that misery, brought me into a program where each night when I walk in, I'm gently reminded of what it was, and given me a 12-step solution to clean it up. And if that isn't done and people move away, ask them when they relapse. They literally forget the misery. They can't even remember it for you. What do we tell newcomers? Think the drink through. If you're sitting there thinking, I can have that drink, think it through. Think your last drink through. What was it? Where did it take you? What did you do? And you say, hey, it wasn't my last drink. Oh, you smart ass. Think about the one before that then, you know? But you can find that drink that led you right down the hounds of hell. You can find it. All you got to do is just want it bad enough to pray bad enough to remember it and be going into enough meetings where I can hear Rick tell me a story. I'm like, yes, that's where it was. Very few lilies and daffodils and roses. And by going to meetings, I get to hear that. Big book I've talked about. Let me say this about the big book. I've had people come in and say, I got a letter today in the mail from a young man that heard me speak down in somewhere in the South. And he said, I don't know what to do. I have a sponsor who tells me I don't need to do my 4-step for a year because my memory is so bad. He said, what? I heard you say, what am I supposed to do? What I said was, by watching, that's bullshit, first of all. And the reason I can tell you it's bullshit, because we got a 45-bed non-medical detox. We bring these men in off of the street. Every down drunk in Jefferson County, a million population, is brought to that non-medical detox. Only 15% of people need detox, medical detox. You don't know who those are, so don't you try to do it to yourself, okay? Because 15% of those people will die if they go into DTs. But we have people who can watch them and decide, because 85% won't. They walk across that street, and we give them a big book, and within the first 2 weeks, when they walk into our program, and they're sitting there, their fly may be unzipped, but they're reading the big book, and they're getting it. Because they're sitting there writing their fourth step, I mean within the first month. Just like those drunks did in Akron and in Cleveland and in New York, when they gave them a big book. They didn't even have a big book. They let them read the book of James, one of Paul's letters to the Corinthians, but they had them cleaning up their mess and helping a drunk. Going to do a four-step? Sure, medical science has studied us. They call it the post-acute recovery syndrome. Wilson said for a year and a half he couldn't get a job because he was racked with waves of self-pity and resentment. He described the post-acute recovery syndrome in 38. Medical science described it in 79 as loss of short-term memory for 6 months to 2 years. Simple problem solving, stress management. Sleep patterns. Everything that a new drunk goes through. Can't find my car. Hell, I lost my car drinking all the time. I lost my car sober for a year. I mean, literally lost it for a year. One time I lost it in an 11-place parking lot. That's right. Hell, I used to come off of the golf green for a year after I got sober, and I was really feeling good about me because I could tell the truth about how to spot my golf ball. I used to cheat all the time on a golf course, and I'd walk off that green feeling good about me. Couldn't find my damn golf cart about half the time, but I could walk off that green feeling good about me. You're going to have sawdust for brains for 6 months to 2 years. But you can read the book. You can do what the book says, and you can get a sponsor, and you can go to meetings. And I'm going to write this man back and say, let me talk to your sponsor. Because I want to hear the whole story. Because you could damn near see the tear marks on this paper. And if you think that's exaggerated, you should read it. And I've got the experience to tell me what it's like not to do the work. And I've worked with close to 2,000 or 3,000 homeless men who are doing it. And watching the joy in their lives at 2 and 3 and 4 months. Sure, it won't be the last four step they'll do. It won't be the last one you'll do. Honesty. Only people can't get this program are the ones who can't be honest. Read the first chapter of how it works, the first paragraph of how it works. Read it. It'll tell you how much honesty means. And one day at a time, I can get myself out chasing in the tall grass by not staying in the day. We know the story. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. I grew up in a little town in western Kentucky named Mayfield. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol, no drugs. My grandfather died drinking lye water in Mayfield City Jail. I've told you that story. I was a perfect kid because mother wanted me to be perfect. I had a good mind. I had a lot of energy. It was a very loving home. It was a very crazy home, but it was a very loving home. I've never been in a home that I thought was any more loving than the home I grew up in. I remember the night that I left to go to college. I was laying in bed and I was looking up the wall at the ceiling. I said, dear God, if I ever have a son, I want him to be just like me. And that was a reasonable statement because I was a perfect kid. I really was a nice kid. Be careful what you pray for. You may get it. I've got a daughter, 35, who's been in AA 15 years, and a son, 29, who's been in AA 13 years. AA raised my children. AA raised my children. They had a crazy mother and an alcoholic, sick daddy. And AA raised my children. The children in AA are our great gift and our great responsibility because they will be the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. I call them little starlings because they run in and shit right on the floor and they run right out and they make a hell of a lot of noise. But I'll tell you what, they are the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I won't see it, but some of y'all may when somebody will stand up and say, my name is Sam Smith, and I've been sober 70 years. I've been sober 70 years, and that's because Claire and me and John and some of those other people and Rick and whoever was here so that those little kids when they were 16 could be put up with while they just be 16-year-olds and learn the principles of living. Went to college, no problem. Went to high school, no problem. Got in medical school, and there's always been a motor running in me. That's the way my mind works. All just like it. If you haven't seen it already, that's the way my mind works. Always been a motor running in me. Always been a motor running in me. And I never knew there was a motor running in me until I took my first amphetamine my freshman year in medical school. It was flying apart. I mean, I was flying apart, getting ready to go home after 2 weeks. Somebody gave me a capsule of amphetamine. I took that amphetamine. That motor stopped. It just stopped. I found four things that'll stop my motor: amphetamine, alcohol, sex, and Alcoholics Anonymous. They've done two workups on me for sexual addiction. When I saw that essay, I really was kind of excited about it. I really was looking forward to the talks. You know, great talks in SA. Yeah. The results are inconclusive, but in any event, AA works better than anything else for me. It just takes a little longer. And they haven't put me in jail one time for going to AA meetings, and I got put in jail for all three of those others. I did not know that was a police woman. I thought $50 was a good price. But I only did it once, right? I only did it once. Amphetamine on me from almost the first amphetamine. I got kicked out of medical school two weeks before graduation in 1962. They put me in intensive psychiatric therapy. Said when you figure out why you take that drug, you can quit. Their philosophy was that you're going to think yourself into a way of acting. I've already described to you the post-acute recovery syndrome. It's why rational recovery won't work. It's why moderation management won't work, because you got sawdust for brains. Anybody thinks that we can rationally, cognitively push this thing through, at least for a drunk of my type, for 2 years, I got sawdust for brains, and 2 and 2 makes 12. I don't give a damn how I add it. And if they want me to use my brain to figure this out, then they got a losing proposition from the beginning. For a year and a half, I was in intensive therapy. They worked with me. I got back into medical school, and within 30 minutes, I didn't take any amphetamine. Alcohol wasn't a part of my history at that time. And got back into medical school, and within 30 minutes, I was strung out on amphetamine. Just sat and cried because I didn't know why. My classmates enabled me. When I'd get too hot, they'd take me home. I was married, had one small child. She'd call the medical school, and my wife wouldn't tell them I had the flu. They knew better, but they didn't know what to do. I graduated in 1964. Between 64 and 67, I was in Our Lady of Peace, a mental hospital, four times. Strapped down, IV fluid, straight jackets, padded cells. I might stay off amphetamine 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months. It didn't matter. But I always went back, and it always put me in a mental hospital. At that time, they didn't even know the issue of tolerance involved the speed drugs. They said that that didn't work, that you didn't develop tolerance. Well, today we know differently, and certainly in my clinical history, I knew that long before I was in medical science, because I'd reached the point to where I could stay off of it for 6 months, almost a year, take an amphetamine, and within a matter of 2 or 3 days, I would be just screaming with it. And they put me in a mental hospital. Went in the Army in 67, almost got put in Leavenworth for taking amphetamine. Stayed off of it for a year, came home, got back on it when I started my practice. Had a gallbladder attack, which they attributed to amphetamine and the effect it did on the vascular supply to my gallbladder. May or may not have been true, but that's what they told me. My internist, who's still my internist, sat beside my bed when they took my gallbladder out, along with my surgeon, who's still a good friend of mine, and two members of the board of last year who are now dead. And they all held hands, and we prayed together that I would get off the amphetamine. My last amphetamine was 1969, somewhere between 69 and 70. I didn't quit taking amphetamine because I thought I was powerless. Never even considered that. I quit taking amphetamine because I was tired of the consequences. I was tired of being put in mental institutions. I was tired of all the consequences. That was not going to be true with alcohol. I started drinking in 1970. First 4 years of my drinking, wasn't alcoholic. I might get drunk, might stay sober. Never thought about it much one way or another. Didn't get in any trouble with it. My wife and I didn't get along, but hell, we never gotten along. Next 3 years of my drinking was alcoholic. I didn't drink as often, didn't get drunk as much, but every minute of every day I thought about when my first drink was going to come, and I knew exactly when it was going to come. It was going to come at 4:15. I walked out of that office at 4 o'clock, walked across that street, got me a quart of beer, put it between my legs, drove 25 miles to where I lived, had finished a quart of beer, walked in, got my scotch and water, and got to exactly where I wanted to be every single night. And it was predictable. I knew what it would do. Then it turned on. In the last year of my drinking, I drank a quart of whiskey a night and told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. And I had to believe it. You know it. I had to believe it. If Finally, I reached a point in time where I couldn't stand the lies. I couldn't stand me. I couldn't stand the pain. I couldn't stand the pain in my mother and daddy's eyes. I couldn't stand the pain in my children's eyes. I couldn't stand the pain in Casey's eyes. I couldn't stand the pain in my partner's eyes. And one day, Casey and I had moved in together, and we lived together for about 6 months, and she'd gone to work that morning. I was sitting in a chair, and I couldn't get drunk, and I couldn't get sober. I couldn't live with it. I couldn't live without it. I couldn't stand the lies. I did not know what to do. And I said, God, please help me. And from here on, it gets real personal. And you don't have, and if you're new in this program, you probably will say, God, I hope I can feel that way someday. If you're not new in this program, you'll know exactly what happened. I said, God, please help me. And the peace that came over me was absolutely measurable. I knew exactly what I had to do, and I was at complete peace with it. I walked into my bedroom and loaded my shotgun and put it in my mouth. I was out of here. I was not scared of dying. I welcomed it. That was the only way I knew to quit drinking. I was terrified of living because I didn't know how. I thought, well, Casey, it'll hurt Casey. And I thought, no, she'll be better off without me. Thought about my parents, and I said, no, I've hurt them so much. And I thought of my kids, and the only reason I didn't pull that trigger, at that very moment of complete self-absorption, all I could think of was my children. And I did not want my children to know their daddy died that way. And I remember laying down the gun and screaming, God, you son of a bitch, get off of me. I just want to go. But all I can think of, I don't want my children to know their daddy died that way. And I crawled and screamed over to the phone and called a psychiatrist who was a friend of mine, went to his office. He sent me to Payne Whitney Clinic in New York for about 10 days. Didn't know what else to do with me. My roommate hanged himself. I knew I was in the wrong place, not because he hanged himself, but because by that time I realized that, you know, they talked about depression, and I was depressed. Hell, 100% of alcoholics are depressed. 60% will get better within we were talking tonight, 60% will get clear of depression within a month, just getting off the poison. Another 32% will get better within a year, learning how to live. That leaves 8% that'll need medicine. We don't know who those 8% are, but 92% won't. That's why you need to see a doctor like me or someone who's a specialist in this field before you decide whether you should be on medicine or when you're going to be on medicine and what it should be. Because 92% of us don't need it, but I don't know who you are, but somebody can figure it out. They wanted to treat me for depression, and finally at the end of 10 days I thought, shit, I don't need to be treated for depression. I need to be treated for alcoholism. I called David and he said, you're right, sent me down to an alcohol treatment center in Atlanta. I stayed for 4 months, came home and got into AA. I asked y'all what I had to do, and you said, you do anything we tell you to do, you're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. And I began to do that. AA is so perceptive and so profound, it knew we couldn't think, we had to act. First year was crazy. I'd call my sponsor 5 and 6 times a day. I'd walk in and see a patient, do just fine, walk out and stand in the hall and just shake. I'd go in my office and drop on my knees and I'd say, God, please help me, pick up the phone, call my sponsor. Jim would answer the phone and I'd say, Jim, I'm flying apart. And he'd say, did you get up on time? Yeah. Did you eat your breakfast? Yeah. Did you do your meditation? Yeah. Did you get the office on time? Yeah. You seeing your patients on time? Yeah. You going to eat your lunch? Yeah. You coming to the meeting tonight? Yeah. You'll be okay. Thanks, Jim. I'd hang up. I'd go out for 5 or 6 other patients and then walk out in the hall, start shaking. I'd go in and I'd say, God, please help me. I'd pick a phone. I'd call Jim. I said, Jim, I'm flying apart. He said, did you get up on time? Yeah. Did you eat your breakfast? Yeah. Same damn deal. I always felt better. 5, 6, 7, 8 times a day sometimes. Had a tooth pulled when I was 6 months sober, and my sponsor stood on one side of me with my wife, and they held my hand while a good friend of mine, who was a fraternity brother of mine in college, pulled my tooth. I'm 42 years old, and I got my wife and my sponsor holding my hand while they pulled my tooth. After it's over, he said, Burns, don't you feel like a wimp? And I said, no, I felt pretty good. You want to know the truth? I hate dentists. I'm scared of them. I don't hate them. I'm just scared of them, which means I hate them because I hate everything I'm scared of. In the second year, I started getting better, and then by the end of the third year, shit, I had it, man. I was little Mr. AA. Get up on time, do your meditations, get to the office, see your patient, call your sponsor, get to eat your lunch, get to the meetings, greet the newcomer, set up the ashtray, set up the coffee, give them your telephone number, get home in the evening, talk to your wife, call your sponsor, call the newcomer, make love to your wife, and go to sleep. Bum, 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 bum. Little Mr. Perfect AA, right? Five years in the program, I was like this, and I mean the old timers, and they say, Burns, how do you feel? And I said, I'm fine. This is a smile, you idiot. I was so dry you could have set me on fire with a fart. I mean, that's just exactly where I was. And I was down in South Georgia visiting my spiritual director. We don't talk about it much, but I had a sponsor and a spiritual director, an Episcopal priest, lived next door to me and one of my best friends. And he'd moved to South Georgia, and Casey and I were down there visiting him. And I came back home after, or came back to the motel, and I dropped on my knees, and I said, God, take away the pain. And Casey put her hands on my shoulder, said, call your sponsor. My first sponsor had a two-step program, 1 and 12. But let me tell you what God delivered to me through this man. I called Jim and I said, Jim, I'm flying apart. Will I ever get it? And he said, I don't know. You're the most compliant person I've ever seen, but I don't know. I said, Jim, I just don't know what to do. And he said, come home, we'll talk about it. And I started hanging up. He said, no, don't hang up. I said, let me ask you something. He said, do you believe if you work these steps perfectly today, it'll make you good? I said, yeah. And he said, you're wrong. He said, do you believe if you get drunk today, it'll make you bad? And I said, yeah, I do. And he said, you're wrong. I said, I don't understand. He said, Burns, you've been trying to buy something that isn't for sale. It's given for fun and for free. God loves you just the way you are. You can't earn it. You can't kick it away. He loves you just the way you are. He'll love you drunk. He'll love you sober. He'll love you in the wrong bed. He'll love you in the right bed. Now, if you want to feel good about you, you better be in the right bed. And you better stay sober. But God's going to love you wherever you are. You're His child. And I was ready. And the teacher came. I came to know a God who loves me just as I am. Just as I am. I tried to be perfect for Mama and she couldn't handle it. I tried to be perfect for me and I couldn't do it. I tried to be perfect for God and He didn't need it. My whole life changed. I've never doubted God's love since then. It's a wonderful relationship I have with my God. I don't have to ask my God for forgiveness. My God doesn't judge. But I'll tell you, without that anchor of fear of my God, I became pretty lethal. That's when I had the affair, because there was no more governor on me. Then I came to know a God who loves me just as I am, and I learned to love me by following the rules. And what a combination. 4 years ago, my wife and I went into therapy together because she literally did not know about this relationship until there came an appropriate time for me to talk with her about it. And that appropriate time was almost, and I went and spent 4 days in Southeast Georgia with a couple and another individual with 90 years of sobriety and almost 90 years of relationship experience to work through the steps to know what I could, should, and should not tell my wife. I was willing, and they helped me with that. But I had destroyed a lot of the intimacy in our relationship. I still had a lot of work to do on my own anger and victimization, my own resentment at not being able to do whatever it was I damn well pleased. My wife and I were celibate for 4 years. Between 10 years of recovery and 14 years of recovery. By this time, I really fell in love with the other woman. I really did love both women. I was as much in love as I could fall. And it really was a grief type thing, because this was not a shallow person. This was a very lovely woman. And then Casey and I talked and we went to therapy. Now, by this time, I had an incredibly good program of my own, and she had an incredibly good program of her own, and we took those really strong spiritual programs into therapy. Therapy without strong spiritual programs for recovering people generally doesn't work. The way mine worked is it kept my ass on the seat sometimes when I wanted to get up and leave. It kept me there and vulnerable and listening. And the last 3 years of our marriage has been absolutely wonderful. I love this woman with a depth that I never thought I was capable of loving anybody, and it's real obvious that not only does she love me that way, she always has. But it took some work with the program and within the program and with a therapist who knows the 12-step process to give us the advantage that God knew that we deserved to have. I've learned some things that I think are important to share, and you've been very patient. One is I stand on the shoulders of giants, but with the program you've given me, I don't have to stand in the shadow of anybody. About 3 years ago, I grew up. It was a hell of a deal. I woke up and I thought, I'll be damned, I'm a man. With all my warts and with all my wings, with all of my godliness and with all of my devils and demons, I'm a man. And I welcomed it and I cherish it. And it has come as a direct result of being a drunk who came home to you and followed what I found and learned from you. I took amphetamine for 12 years with no alcohol. I took alcohol for 7 years with no amphetamine. They both nearly destroyed me. At 17 years in sobriety, I had a heart attack, nearly died. I knew what I was having when I had it, and they rolled me, and I grabbed Casey, and we went to the emergency room, and I rolled into the emergency room. And I knew the guy who was running the emergency room. I ran in, and I called him by name. I said, I'm having a heart attack. And he said, jump on the bed. And I got on the bed, and he ran the EKG and said, Burns, you're in trouble. You've had an anterior septal infarct. Who's your cardiologist? And I remember thinking, you dumb shit, whoever's out in the hall is my cardiologist. You know, dear God, we're not going to arbitrate my care right now. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Call your local doctor, right? You know? By this time, they had enough morphine in me, I was thinking. And so it turns out one of the top cardiologists in the city was in the hall, and he came in. He said, Burns, you're in real trouble. He said, can I give you this medicine? We call it perfusion, and he gave me this medicine that dissolved the clot, saved my heart. The downside of that is I had two bouts of cardiac arrhythmia where my heart beat very erratically, and I immediately went into ventricular fibrillation, which is one of the major causes of instant death from a heart attack, and they had to put those electric shockers on my chest. Now, the first time I passed out, and they shot me, and I came to him, and I said, Dan, what happened? He said, you fibrillated. I said, how am I doing? He said, you're doing okay. In about 3 or 4 minutes, I started to pass out, and I said, I'm going to pass out again. He said, yeah, you're fibrillating again. He said, I'm going to have to shock you awake. He put them suckers on my chest awake. Now, that's a real spiritual experience. I'm here to tell you. It really was. And I was pretty fragile after all that, and so they put me on IV Ativan. Now, that's Turbo Valium. And I told the heart doctor, I said, I'm going to have to call in a specialist in the field of addiction to take care of me. He said, why not? I told him about the Ativan. He said, then I won't give it to you. And I said, would you give it to any other heart patient? He said, yeah. I said, then you damn well give it to me. Because you saved my life, and I'm going to have him save my ass, okay? So Charlie came in, and he said, Burns, you're going to be in trouble. And I said, I know it, but take care of me. So they gave me IV Ativan for 8 days. They cathed me 4 days later, roto-rooted one of my arteries, and cleaned me up real good, and sent me home at the end of 8 days, and they gave my wife some of these capsules to taper me, 10-10-10-9-9-9-8-8-8-7-7-7. So after the third day, I'm doing fine. After the third day, I went into full-blown withdrawal. Complete blackout, the whole deal. 17 years of sobriety, 8 days of IV Ativan. Wasn't clandestine. We're sitting in the bedroom, and I'm looking at her, and she's got stuff in her purse, and I walk over and pick up her purse and take it out, and have 25 of them in there, and I take them. She said something to me, and I don't know what she said, but she told me what she said. She said, what the hell are you doing? I said, what I said to her, I don't remember, but she told me what I said, is this stuff is screwing me up, and when I get it all taken, I won't have to take anymore. Then I went over and sat on... Yeah. Then I went over and sat on the foot of the bed, and I remember, I said, this will wear off in the morning, I'll have to go write a prescription, take some more. And I started crying, I said, it's got me, and she said, it's got you. They transferred me to Our Lady of Peace, the mental hospital, and I went through a bone-rattling detox. Amphetamine for 12 years, no benzodiazepine, no alcohol, nearly died. Alcohol for 7 years, no amphetamine, no benzodiazepine, nearly died. 8 days of benzodiazepine with no alcohol, no amphetamine. Hooked, tighter than a tick. Message is real clear. Mood-altering medicine doesn't work in us like it does in normal people. That's my experience. That doesn't mean as an alcoholic you shouldn't have what you need. Oh, let me tell you, 3 months in the program, I decided to have a vasectomy. Yeah, and I decided since they taught me I shouldn't have mood-altering medicine, I'd have it done under local. They laid me down on the table, and about 1 second into that procedure, I thought, you've made a grave error in judgment. That's right. And it caused a cremasteric reflex, which means that That's why when you get hit in the testicles, they pull up and you fall down and puke. That's why we do that. Well, the way it worked in me was the blood pressure dropped out. And I literally called orthostatic hypotension. For 3 days, I peed in a number 10 fruit jar because I couldn't stand up. And after 3 days, I called my sponsor and I said, "This has been a, you'll be so proud of me. I've had a wonderful experience. I didn't take any medication. I had this vasectomy." He said, "You're an idiot." The message is that we do have a power greater than ourselves and that we do share with that. And finally, I'll close, and you've been real patient. I've been kind of, it's just been a night when I just wanted to kind of meander and talk. And for those of you that are tired, go to sleep. Those of you who are still awake, I want to tell one more story and I'll quit. It has to do with my family. My mother died in 78, and I made all my amends to her, and I was 8 months sober, and it was a wonderful experience. I miss her every day. Both my children are in AA, and they say the single most significant impact in their lives was their daddy drinking, and the single most significant impact in their life was their daddy sober. Because they said, "Daddy, we knew what to do because you had shown us what to do." Third has to do with my father. After my mother died, I would go try to make my amends to my daddy, and daddy wouldn't talk to me. Well, my daddy was a very quiet man. He never said anything. He was just always there. My daddy was just always there. And one of the most gentle people I've ever known. I mean, he never said, "I loved you," and he never hugged, but he was just always there. When I ever needed anybody, my daddy was there. I would go to tell him I was sorry, and he wouldn't listen to me. And I got to tell you, working with those thousands of men at homeless shelter, I've done at least 60 to 75 fifth steps, and every one of those men I found one a significant male to tell him it's okay. There come a day when that isn't necessary, but it always feels good. And I wanted my daddy to tell me it was okay. That's what I wanted. And daddy couldn't respond. My sponsor said, "Quit trying to cram it down your daddy's throat." Of course, that's in the big book. But I wanted desperately for daddy to say, "It's okay." My daddy died about, my daddy married about a year after mother died and married a wonderful lady. Then my daddy began to lose his mind. Alzheimer's, senile dementia, but he forgot who I was, forgot who my mother was, forgot who my brother was. And finally, Peggy and I had to put him in a nursing home. And I'd drive down at least once or twice a month, sometimes every weekend, to see my daddy. And I'd been sober about 10 or 11 years at that time. And I'd park the car and I'd say, "God, take away my pain. Take away my pain," because it was awful to watch daddy doing this. And I'd go in and work with daddy all day, get in the car and drive 250 miles back home and cry all the way back. Never changed. One day I drove down, and I don't know why, I'd just been doing these wonderful miracles that I've shared with you, and I drove in and parked the car, and I said, "Dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be." I went in, he was sitting in a wheelchair, I didn't call him daddy, that confused him. I said, "How can I help you?" And he said, "Yeah, Buster," he thought I was his brother. He said, "Would you shave me?" And I shaved daddy. And I said, "Hal, would you like to have some lunch?" And he said, "I believe I would," and I rolled him out there, and he was too weak to feed himself, and I fed him. Peggy came in, sat down, and she and I got to talking, and daddy was sitting there watching us in his wheelchair, and mother and I used to do this all the time, and daddy would just watch, and he loved to listen, watch us talk. And I turned around and said, "Would you like to go out on the porch?" And he said, "I believe I would," and I rolled him out there, and Peggy and I got to talking, and we were just talking back and forth. Daddy sitting there watching, he raised up in his chair, and he looked at me, he said, "Son, today you just like the little boy your mother and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me." 10 seconds later, he didn't know me, and he never knew me again. We buried him 3 years ago. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that my daddy recognized me. It's that this self-centered alcoholic said, "Let me be for my daddy what you want me to be." Not a change in what we see, but a change in how we see it. If you're there, you know what I mean. If you're not, stick around. It'll happen. I love you. Thank you for loving me. Thank you for letting me come into your life tonight.